Let's begin.
All right, fantastic. So it was asked that I do a very, 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 very short review about who Rav Ovadia Yosef was. So Rav Ovadia Yosef, he came also from Iraq. Last week we spoke a lot about the differences between him and the Ben Ish Chai, someone who passed away in the year 1909, a great, great rabbi, and we discussed some of the differences, and tonight we're going to speak a little bit more about that also. What happened was is that one of the main things that we said about Rav Ovadia, this happens to be my favorite part, one of the main things about Rav Ovadia that we spoke about last week is that Rav Ovadia was like the LeBron. LeBron does not even know, I don't know, maybe he knows now, he did not know who his father was growing up. He grew up in the poorest places, very, very, very not good. And you have on the left over there, you have Steph Curry. You have someone who grew up in the lap of luxury. He grew up with a father in the NBA. And we said that in order to become a tzaddik, in order to become a great rabbi, it's good to be, we coined it last week, an SOS, the son of a saint. As we mentioned over here, Rav Soloveitchik comes from a great line of rabbis. Rav Moshe Feinstein comes from a great line of rabbis. And Rav Eliashiv comes from a great line of rabbis, and on and on and on. And Rav Ovadia had absolutely none of these advantages. We also said that he was tremendously humble in terms of his humble beginnings were very, very, very austere, very, very poor. In fact, we even told over the legend that the reason why he had to wear sunglasses when he got older was because he used to use the municipality lights because his own family was so poor they could not even afford lights at all. He got married at a pretty young age. He was absolutely tremendous. We mentioned that his father used to go from place to place, from wedding hall to wedding hall, singing all sorts of Mizrahi songs, not a scholar in the slightest. We spoke last week all about how he kicked Rav Ezra Atiyah out of his store. He said, I don't care if you come here and you say you're going to donate your own time. My son, Ovadia Yosef, is not going to yeshiva. Eventually what happened was, if you guys remember, Malachim came, not Ganavim. Angels came and not robbers. And what they did is that they cleared out the store. Rav Ovadia Yosef's father said, I don't want you in the store anymore. And he sent them back to yeshiva. He sent them to Parat Yosef. From Parat Yosef, he ended up becoming the Av Beit Din. He ended up becoming the head of the rabbinical court in Egypt, in Cairo, in Cairo. We mentioned that that community was going downhill fast, and he was sent basically to be a band-aid on a huge wound. He actually did fantastic stuff during those 3 years, but you know, he eventually had to come back. When he came back, he eventually became the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv after, you know, being rabbi in different places, rabbi in Petah Tikva. He ended up being part of a huge rabbinical court, which is really fantastic, which we're actually going to talk a lot about today. And we mentioned that he got the Israel Prize in 1970 for the first volume of a sefer called Yabia Omer. Yabia Omer is his 10-volume magnum opus. Rav Ovadia's tshuvot, as we mentioned last week, are tremendously lengthy, very, very long. This is the time before Bar Ilan. This is the time before using the computer, before all this stuff. And his mind is absolutely incredible, very much someone with a photographic memory. He won the Israel Prize. Then we spoke about really... I mean, according to Dr. Benny Lau, who we mentioned last week, Dr. Benny Lau, he's the rabbi of the Ramban Shul in Katamon. He got his doctorate from Dr. Daniel Sperber at Bar Ilan University, and his doctorate was this book, Maran, it's Mimaran Ad Maran, from the Shulchan Aruch until Rav Ovadia. There's no one like those two great figures. So Dr. Lau, he says something absolutely incredible. He said that just alone, 1973 alone, just the stuff that he did during that time in terms of helping all of the agunot, helping all of the chained women who their husbands were completely lost, that alone, Rav Ovadia, that his whole place is just assured for history, and anything else, no matter what other stuff he does, everything else pales in comparison to that. I also want to mention this book. I forgot to mention this last week. It's very cool. This book is tremendously worn. I don't know if you've noticed. Not because I love this book so much, which I do, but why is it very worn? I went to Grus Kollel. Grus Kollel is in Bai Vagan. So right next to Grus Kollel is Yeshiva Chevron. Chevron is like the MIT. It's like the Harvard of Yeshivot, especially now, because there's a huge fight going on in Panovich. I don't know if you guys have been following the Yeshiva Shach. Probably not. But basically, Yeshiva Chevron is like the top of the top. Rav Ovadia Yosef's grandson learns Yeshiva Chevron. I became friends with him. I lent him this book. He devoured it. He absolutely loved it, which made me very happy. He loved it. It was great. So, this is where we stopped last week. We said that Rav Ovadia in 1983 gets kicked out of the chief rabbinate. The very last thing, I just want to speak a little bit about the bold psakim that he had, since we really went through this very, very fast, and I'll go through it very fast again. We spoke about milk and meat at the same counter. That Rav Avadya said that you could give a hashgacha to a restaurant that gives meat and milk even at the same counter. That's one thing. We said that there's a halachic justification for women to wear pants. We said that. We said Ethiopian Jewry. We said that Rav Avadya said that they are 100% Jewish and therefore they should be included among the laws of return. We said that Rav Avadya said gelatin even from a pig is 100% kosher. We said Eru for a Sephardi. We spoke about dishwashers. We spoke about a bat mitzvah. We spoke a little bit about Judith Kaplan, about Mordechai Kaplan's daughter, about how Rav Avadya does not have to face the same issues, you know, facing Ashkenazi posek, because he doesn't have to deal with reform and conservative Judaism. He doesn't have to deal with that. So therefore he looks at it at the basis of what halakhically is the problem with the bat mitzvah. And therefore he comes out very, very strongly saying that a bat mitzvah is fantastic. We spoke about conversion, that he says that Giyurei Tzahal, that people that are in Tzahal who are converting, we should accept them in and that we shouldn't push them away. We spoke all about Mechal Shabbos, people who break Shabbat, that they're still able to do Birkat Kohanim, even though the Shulchan Aruch says it's not allowed. Nevertheless, he said that nowadays, people, it's not their fault. Why do we want to push them away? We want to bring them closer. We spoke also a lot about Land for Peace last week, where we said that Rav Avadya, even though he later on changed his mind in 2005 by the Hitnakut, by Gaza, in 1993, which we're actually going to talk about a little bit, in 1993 he decides to join the Rabin government, and basically that leads to the Oslo Accords. We spoke about metal bottle caps on Shabbat. We spoke about a star player from one of the Israeli teams that he was able to convince, don't go by car on Shabbat to the soccer game. Instead, stay at a hotel right next to the soccer stadium and walk. You see Rav Avadya beautifully over here, in terms of you see, on the one hand, really trying to help people out, and on the other hand, really trying to make sure that people are keeping a modicum of Judaism, because the more ahava, the more love that you bring, that's not going to push them away, it's going to be fantastic. We spoke about, the very last thing we spoke about last week was Hallel on Yom HaAtzmaut, where he said that Rav Avadya does bring down that a person should say Hallel on Yom HaAtzmaut without a bracha, but definitely say Hallel. It's definitely important. We also said that Rav Avadya, because of who he is and because he's so controversial, he's very much being written out of the new literature that's being written. For example, the Masifta Gemara, which I picked up last time, the Gemara that's put out by New Square, they are saying absolutely not. We are not going to quote Rav Avadya. They quote him as an anonymous source. It's very silly because I'm reading through it and I'm like, this is Rav Avadya. This is his tshuva. This is what he's talking about. It's very, very silly. We also spoke about the Dirshu Mishabura. We spoke all about this new Mishabura, which quotes from Chaim Kanievsky, and it quotes Rav Vosner, and it quotes all these great rabbis in Israel. The one rabbi who it doesn't quote, Rav Avadya. When it quotes Sfardi Minagim, it quotes another rabbi, it quotes Rav Ben Sion Abba Shaul, who is Rav Avadya's chavrusa. They fought also together. They were frenemies, as my students would say. But what happened was, is that he's quoted as like the Sephardi posek that they're quoting, and for me, when I learned that, I find it to be very silly, because it's not even a competition. Listen, I'm nobody, as they always say, you know, if you're on the bottom of Manhattan, you take a look up, you don't see the skyscrapers, but it's very well known in terms of Rav Avadya is like the prime Sephardi posek. To say otherwise is really not being honest. So, now we could pick up. I hope that was a good enough introduction from last week. We really like crunched it tremendously. So, 1983 is when we stopped last time. The last DeLoreans were being produced. If you know Back to the Future, in Time Magazine, no, it was People Magazine. It was Deborah Winger and Mr. T. They were like the most intriguing people of the year. One of the Beach Boys ended up drowning in California. You know, very, very sad. And 1983, that's also the year that Rav Avadya was kicked out of the Rabbanut. It's the year he was kicked out of the Rabbanut. And that was tremendously bad. We said a little reason. We said that because Rav Avadya had kicked out the person before, Rav Yitzchak Nissim, his son ended up taking the kama, his son took revenge, and ended up causing a whole thing, and basically, let's make term limits, let's make 10-year term limits for the chief rabbinate, and that's exactly what happened. And after that, he came in 1973, he left in 1983. That seems to be one reason. However, the main reason is something that I want to talk about for the next few minutes. It's something called the Langer case. The Langer case. By a show of hands, I'm very curious. Who here has ever heard of the Langer case? Because this, I mean, now it's funny, there's not nearly enough literature on this. Like, it's fascinating. I find it to be absolutely fascinating. So, in Poland in the 1920s, I know this is about as far away from Iraq and Rav Avadia you can get, but let's get to Poland in the 1920s. What happened was, is that there was a young girl, her name was Chava Ginsburg. That's who's in the center. Chana Ginsburg. And what happened was, is that she met a non-Jewish person, she fell in love with a guy named Borokovsky. And what happened was that Borokovsky, they ended up running away together from their town in Poland, they ended up in Warsaw. And according to the way it's told, Borokovsky ended up converting, and his name became Avram Borokovsky. What happened was that in 1933, the Borokovskys, this family unit, the convert and Chana, they end up going off to Israel. And what happens is that they end up separating. And they end up separating without a get, without a religious divorce. And that becomes a major issue because in 1944, Chana ended up meeting a soldier named Otto Langer. He was a British soldier who was in Israel, and she meets Otto Langer, and they fall in love. And what happens is they end up having two kids. They end up having Chava and Chanoch. They end up having a boy and a girl, Chava and Chanoch. And what happens is that in 1951, Avram Borokovsky wants to go ahead and remarry. So he goes over to Beit Din, he goes over to rabbinical court, and he says, I want to divorce my wife. As they're discussing, as they're talking about the case, it ends up being that it's revealed that Chana ends up being married or is having some sort of relationship with Otto Langer. So at that point, it's decided by the Beit Din that Otto Langer and Chana Ginsburg cannot be together. This has to do with a famous Gemara that ends up being that the woman, if she is still married to her husband, any relationship she has with another person, she is always going to be prohibited from that person. So therefore, since she cheated on her husband, Avram Borokovsky, with Otto Langer, it now means she can't be married to Avram Borokovsky, which obviously that's not happening, but also she can't ever have a relationship with Otto Langer. Now that was obviously a very big problem and a huge shock to everybody, but the shock really came in 1951. When they found out that there are really two kids that come from Otto Langer and Chana Ginsburg. And this was a major, major, major disaster. This was terrible. And what happens is, halachically, these kids, we could talk a lot about this in terms of we could have shiurim and shiurim, but they end up being something called mamzerim, or the English term, bastards. They end up being kids that are born from an illicit relationship. A person is always a mamzer. And the halacha is they can only marry other mamzerim. They cannot marry anyone else. There's a lot of discussion about this. There's a Gemara that says that whenever a mamzer happens, a Kadosh Baruch Hu cries, because Hashem understands, what did the kid do? I mean, this is just something that bothers me theologically. In terms of, what exactly did the kid do to deserve this? But what it really ends up being, I mean, one of the best answers I've seen, it's not really an answer, but it's just a way of understanding it, is that really it is to keep the Kiddushah Yisrael, to keep the holiness of the Jewish people, by therefore saying, you better be very, very careful before you step out of the bounds of this marriage, because there's going to be major, major ramifications if you happen to. So what happened was, is that in 1966, things really became bad, because Chanoch ended up becoming engaged, and he ended up going over to the Beit Din. Now he's a mamzer, he's engaged to a perfectly Jewish girl. And they go, and the Beit Din says, you guys are unable to be together. This is 1966, you guys are unable to be together. In the court, the Langers contested, and this is all in 1966. They said, and this is the one way really to get out of this, if you say that Avram Borokovsky was not Jewish, that the conversion was bad, it ends up being that the entire relationship kind of never happened, and therefore the woman was always a single woman, and therefore Chanoch and Chava are not mamzerim. They're fine. So therefore, there became a huge discussion. What exactly was his practice in Europe, in Warsaw? What happened directly after he converted? What was he like when he came to Israel? A lot of different discussions. It ends up being that they asked him, for example, to say the Pasuk Shema. So they said, Shema Yisrael. He said, Elkeinu Melech HaOlam. So he messed that up. However, there's all sorts of testimony. He put on tefillin. He used to go to synagogue. A lot of very, very interesting stuff. Very, very interesting stuff, which I really don't want to get too much into that. So in 1970, This is a huge fight that's going on. In 1970, a Beit Din of Rav Shaul Yisraeli, who was he later on becomes the Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz Arav, which was started by Rav Cook, who I'm sorry we're not talking about tonight, but Merkaz Arav, the Yeshiva Merkazi in Yerushalayim, he's a huge, 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 huge rabbi, very, very ardent Zionist, an amazing person. He ends up starting a whole organization called Eretz Chemda, which I'm sure a lot of us are very familiar with. It's a great organization in Israel that tries bridging the gap between Orthodox and the non-Orthodox. Really, really, really fantastic. Also on this Beit Din in 1970, Rav Eliashiv, Rav Yosef Shalom Eliashiv, who ended up passing away really 2 years ago in the summer, ends up passing away at the age of 103, the primary Lithuanian Gaon. At this point, he wasn't this anti-Zionist, Haredi person. At this point, he's firmly in the Rabbanut. And as we're going to see, this is going to be a major, major watershed event for Jewry. Also, who was the very third person on this Beit Din? So we said Rav Yisraeli, we said Rav Eliashiv, number three was Rav Ovadia. And they went ahead and they researched and they did everything, and it came out that you could take away the doodads, the quotations, because it turns out they come out and they say, without a doubt, Avram Burakovsky was Jewish. They tried the best they could, but it just turns out the conversion was good, the one that happened in Warsaw, and that means that Chava and Chanoch are 100% Mamzerim. And that was a major, major, major problem. Because what was the big problem with that? Chava and Chanoch, they were part of the IDF. They were part of the Israeli Defense Forces. In 1973, if you learn, you know, I'm sure you guys are amazing, so you guys know everything. But in 1973, one of the big railing points of the Jewish state was the IDF. This will be a way to meld all of these different cultures. This will be a way that we'll all get together. And therefore, the IDF was seen to be very, very supreme. So therefore, you're having this religious authority going ahead and saying, IDF, no, 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 this is not going to happen. That becomes a very, very, very big issue. So therefore, you have Moshe Dayan. Moshe Dayan, he ends up really, this is very, very interesting. He ends up coming out and saying, basically, let the Langers marry who they want, or what we're going to do, we're going to push you away, we're going to push the Rabbanut away, and we will now only have civil marriages. That is it, which is a huge discussion going on right now in Israel, which I'm not touching with Temple Kempo. So in 1973, with the election of Rav Gorin, and Rav Ovadia as the chief rabbis, Rav Gorin sought to have the case reviewed. He wanted to have it seen again. Maybe we missed something, maybe we didn't. And what happened was, is that he came over and he said, Rav Ovadia, we're going to have a new Beit Din. We're going to have a new rabbinical court. It's going to be me. It's going to be you. It's going to be another rabbi that we choose. Rav Ovadia says, are you serious? We already looked at this case. Rav Shaul Yisraeli, Gadol Ador. Rav Eliashiv, Gadol Ador. Me, I don't know if he said this, but Gadol Ador. You have three of the biggest rabbis in the entire world going ahead and saying, Avram Burakovsky is 100% Jewish. Why on earth could we actually go ahead and re-look at this? There's nothing else to look at. Not to mention, Rav Ovadia knew, and this was probably the worst kept secret ever, Rav Gorin had already come out with a psak halacha already that he handed out to some of his best friends, where he shows that Avram Burakovsky was not Jewish. So therefore, Rav Ovadia says, I'm not going to be a part of your farce. I'm not going to do it. However, because of all of this pressure and everything, it's a huge disaster. And what happens is that Rav Gorin ends up by himself, he ends up writing an entire psak allowing it, and he ends up having a rabbi sign on to it. Now what's the problem with those eight rabbis? Nothing, if only we knew who they were. They are eight anonymous rabbis. The issue is that a halachic psak is only as good as the person you're getting it from. So for example, Rabbi Goldberg says something, I say something, Rabbi Goldberg talks a million times better. He knows what he's talking about. I have no idea what I'm talking about. In terms of what exactly are these eight rabbis, who are they, what do they hold? We have no idea. And therefore, a lot of rabbis came out understandably and said, Rav Gorin, what on earth are you doing? But the day Rav Gorin came out with this psak, he was very busy that day. Because what was he doing? He was Mesader Kiddushin for Chanoch and Chava. That day. Now, like I said, I really don't like painting, because Rav Gorin was a tremendous, tremendous person. He was a great Eloi. He learned in Yeshiva Chevron, like we mentioned before. He learned in this MIT, this Harvard of Yeshivot. He was a great Eloi. They tell a story that one time he went over to Rav Kook's house during Pesach time. Rav Kook is sitting in the sukkah, and he's sitting there. And what happens is he's with the Ger Rebbe, and they're talking. I know that's a big deal. The fact that the Ger Rebbe is sitting with Rav Kook, it's amazing. And what happens is that Rav Gorin runs in and he grabs the lapels of Rav Kook and he says, "Answer me this shaila." And then he asks the question, and Rav Kook answers him. And he runs back out off of the table. And the Ger Rebbe says, "Whoa, this person is going to be a very, very, very big person." So we're not talking about a very little person. I also told the story last week that Rav Avadia even told my yeshiva. I went to yeshiva in Netivarye. While I was at Netivarye, Rav Avadia came to visit, and he told this amazing story about Rav Gorin. He said there was an entire ship that was completely not kosher, even though it had to be kosher. Rav Gorin snuck onto the ship in the middle of the night. All of the Navy soldiers, whatever they're called, the naval officers, the sailors, thank you so much, all of the sailors heard crashing, and they heard plates and everything. What was going on in the middle of the night? Rav Gorin was throwing all of the not kosher pots off of the ship. You see, that's Rav Gorin's personality, and you see it exactly the same over here. You see the same, his. I don't want to say it wasn't L'shem Shemayim, because it was L'shem Shemayim. He really thought that Avram Burakovsky, he really thought he was not Jewish. He really believed that. He was just not so good at pshara. He was really not so good at coming to an agreement with people, which is very, very hard, and it really plagued him during the entire rabbinate that he was part of. So at that point, his relationship with Rav Avadia, you could say, was basically nil. Rav Avadia, for the next 10 years, there's a couple biographies about Rav Avadia. So one of the biographies called Maran, which we mentioned last time, by a person named Nitzan Chen and Anshel Pfeffer, they write over there that for those 10 years, Rav Avadia did not say a word to the other chief rabbi, because he was so upset. How on earth could this happen? This had major, major consequences. This had major consequences. Number one, we mentioned Rav Eliashiv before. Rav Eliashiv was part of the Rabbanut. He was Rav Aryeh Levine. Rav Aryeh Levine, the Tzaddik of Yerushalayim, this very ardent Zionist, used to go ahead and visit soldiers, used to go ahead and go over to, all sorts of stuff with Etzel. He was just an incredible person, very, very Zionistic. His son-in-law, Rav Eliashiv, great, great gadol, but this causes Rav Eliashiv to break away from the Zionistic world, and this is it. And because of this, Rav Eliashiv ends up becoming the Gadol Ador, this great rabbi. What's very funny is that the non-Haredi, like the Hasidic people, like for example, the Eda Haredis, they did not really accept Rav Eliashiv, because they said, "Rav Eliashiv, you were close to the Tzionim, you were close to the Zionists early on, and then eventually you left. But because you were part of them, you're too dirty, you can't be part of us." So therefore, it's very sad, very, very sad. But what happened was that caused Rav Eliashiv. This great, great rabbi that could have been such a great force within the Zionistic movement ends up completely going rightward, and that was really the last we hear about Rav Eliashiv when it comes to Tzionim. Another very interesting fact, Rav Eliashiv's Masada Kiddushin was Rav Kook, who I also am not talking about tonight. Number two. So that was the first fallout. The first fallout was losing the great personage Rav Eliashiv to the entire Zionistic movement. Number two, it is the end of any sort of prestige for the chief rabbinate. This is it. It's over. Once already you could see that you could basically steamroll, you could basically do whatever you want, it ends up becoming a major, major, major disaster. And once you have two chief rabbis that are not talking to each other, therefore you end up with obviously all sorts of issues and problems. Rav Avadia during this time, and this is amazing, Rav Avadia, we spoke a lot about his bold, the word, if you would ask me like one word that describes Rav Avadia's Pesachim, he's very, very bold, very, very, very bold. And during this time, he comes out with a lot of his Pesachim, a lot of his halachic decisions, and during this time, he becomes more and more a man of the people, really tremendous. And he's the chief rabbi. He has major issues though in 1983, because in 1983 ends up being he's going to be kicked out. Oh, one more story, I apologize. There's a great story that Mark Shapiro, he's a professor from Scranton, he says that when he was younger, he used to waiter at a summer camp in Deal, New Jersey. And he says that they brought Rav Avadia. This should tell you a lot about Rav Avadia. They brought Rav Avadia. And he said, what did Rav Avadia speak to the students about? What did he speak to the campers about? He said, "Guys, try to wear kippot when we make brachot." He's not telling them, go wear kippot while you're playing basketball, because he knows that's not where they're at. He knows that the Syrian custom, certainly at that point, was not to wear kippot. So therefore, he's telling them, wear it while you're eating, wear it while you're making brachot. That's very, very important. I find that fascinating, very interesting. I mean, you don't see You don't hear Rav Yashiv, for example, you know, psakim of his, you know, like that. So what happens is that in 1983, Rav Avadia is stuck in terms of it's over. The party's over. He's at home, and there's no one coming to the door. There's no one. He's out. In fact, who did they put in charge? They put in charge of Mordechai Eliyahu, another great tzaddik, but you know, in my extremely, extremely humble opinion, nothing to the stature of Rav Avadia. But also, what also must have probably killed Rav Avadia was the fact that Mordechai Eliyahu, he was a follower of the Ben Ish Chai. Like we mentioned before, Rav Avadia, all the way from the time of 17, he said, don't follow the Ben Ish Chai. This is Israel, we follow the Beit Yosef, we follow Rav Yosef Cairo, we don't follow the Ben Ish Chai. Now another rabbi is coming in and saying, guys, we're going to follow the Ben Ish Chai right now. We're going to do that. Now that obviously is a huge, huge issue. All of these years of work he's been working on are now all going to go for nothing. And it was tremendously humiliating for him. And it was really his loneliest time ever. Very, very sad. The members of his family talk about that time in very, very depressing tones, about how sad Rav Avadia was. Because everything, part of his life, like while he was chief rabbi, they say there's not one Israeli city that he did not visit. Like, that's who he was, in terms of he very much was a man of the people going around. Even though he valued his own time tremendously, he felt that spreading Torah was something tremendously important. So, eventually, opportunity knocks. So, who knocked? So, not Walter White, but who knocks? It ends up being Rav Eliezer Menachem Man Shach. Ends up being Rav Shach. Rav Shach is also a very, very, very interesting person. Rav Shach started off very similar to Rav Avadia. Very, very similar to Rav Avadia. Poor, his father was a rabbi, his father died very, very, very young, when he was very young. And life was very bad for him. During World War I, he went from town to town running away from troops. The stories about his life are just incredible in terms of the lengths he went to study Torah are absolutely incredible. They tell a story about him that he only had one shirt during this time, and what he would do is that he would turn the collar around for Shabbat. So at least like the shirt would look quasi-new. After a while, it was just threads, it was disgusting. I mean, he says that like for his birthday, the great birthday present he got was that his feet were so overgrown that finally he went over to a cobbler, and they went ahead and they cut off the front of his shoe, and finally his toes were able to have some air. So he lived a very, very difficult life. And he ended up going to a place called Slutsk. The Rosh Yeshiva of Slutsk was a great rabbi of Isser Zalman Meltzer. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer was a tremendous, tremendous gadol, tremendous tzaddik, a talmid of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik from Volozhin. Great, great, great rabbi. In fact, his son-in-law was Rav Aaron Cutler. Rav Aaron Cutler ended up starting a breakout yeshiva called Kletzk, and that eventually ended up moving to America. And nowadays, the 7,000 people learning in Lakewood Yeshiva, if you take a look at some of the old stationery, it is Yeshiva Kletzk. What is it? It's Yeshiva Kletzk in Lakewood. So what happens is, there's actually a funny story. Does anyone here know who Rav Moshe Aaron Peleyev was? Anyone know any Peleyev family? Oh yeah, absolutely, for sure. So he learned in Slutsk at the same time. So this is a story, it's not in any book. It was told to me by a very person that I trust tremendously. What happened was, is that Rav Aaron Cutler was the son-in-law of Rav Isser Zalman. What happened was, Rav Isser Zalman, before Rav Aaron became his son-in-law, what happened was, is that he was looking for a good shidduch for his daughter. And what happens is, Rav Moshe Aaron Peleyev happens to be away for a couple weeks, and while he's away, he meets a beautiful girl. They end up getting engaged. Incredible. And he comes back to Slutsk. He ends up coming back. And what happens is, Rav Isser Zalman comes over and he says, oh, Rav Moshe Aaron, do you want to be my son-in-law? And he says, oh no, I can't believe it. I just missed out on this. Oh no, I actually just got engaged. So according to the story, what happened was, Rav Isser Zalman said, don't worry, I'll give her to the second best guy in yeshiva. And that happens to be Rav Aaron. I know that story you will not find anywhere. you could definitely see why. So what happens is that Rav Shach ends up marrying the niece. He ends up marrying the niece. He ends up marrying into this royalty. Rav Isser Zalman's family, royalty in the Lithuanian world. And he ends up marrying into it. He ends up marrying Rav Isser Zalman's niece. She actually was like a nurse, which is very interesting. So what happens is, is that Rav Shach's involvement of Torah was tremendous. But what happened was, the very first thing we spoke about was all about Rav Eliashiv leaving in terms of what could have changed. This is now something that I believe to be one of the main things that's responsible for why Eretz Yisrael is the way it is right now. This is my own belief. Take it or leave it. You could just, but this is certainly something that I believe. What happened was, the Rosh Yeshiva of Panovich, the great Rosh Yeshiva of Panovich, his name was Rav Shmuel Rezavsky. If you remember last week, we mentioned that Rav Ovadia used to learn Becharusa with him. And Rav Ovadia even said his Sefer, Shiori Rav Shmuel, is his favorite Acharon. It's his favorite recent rabbi. Everything else, he was not such a fan of Rav Ovadia, but Shiori Rav Shmuel, those are the best. And I have to tell you, I love it. I have the whole set at my house. I absolutely love it. I'm telling you, I kiss them every time. Oh yeah. So, what happened was, he was tremendous. He was a Talmid of Shimon. He survived the Holocaust by going to Shanghai. And what happens is he ends up being chosen by Rav Yosef Kahneman to end up being the next Rosh Yeshiva. There were a few Rosh Yeshiva, and one of them happened to be Rav Shach, but the main Rosh Yeshiva after Rav Kahneman was Rav Shmuel Rezavsky. Just a little bit of stories about Rav Shmuel Rezavsky to tell you about him. And to show you, I mean, what I'm trying to show is how moderate he was. Shmuel Rezavsky, there's a story that's told by his Talmidim. You also won't find this ever in a book, because they're not going to put this in a book, especially nowadays. But what happened was, this was told to me by my Rosh Yeshiva, who learned by him for 10 years. What happened was that one time the student saw him. One time the student saw Shmuel Rezavsky sitting by the radio. And what was he listening to? He wasn't listening to the news. He was listening to a soccer game, USSR versus Israel. USSR versus Israel. And the students couldn't believe it. What are you doing? You're Shmuel Rezavsky. You're the biggest rabbi in the entire world. Should be studying Torah right now. What are you doing listening to this guy? He said, if you would have survived the Holocaust, you would see what a big deal this is in terms of, this is amazing. The state of Israel is fielding a soccer team. That's amazing. Now, obviously, I'm not saying he's like a card-carrying Zionist. I'm not saying that. There's also an amazing story that's told. It's in a book by there's this one rabbi, Rabbi Spiro, who writes a whole bunch of Touched by a Story, Touched by a Soul. I don't remember which volume it is. I saw this years ago. But what happened was that there was once a student in Panovich whose family made him go to the Israeli army. Because in Panovich, it's not really, you don't go to the Israeli army. But his family said, you have to go to the Israeli army. I ended up going to the Israeli army. And he ends up getting a letter. I hope everything's okay. I hope everything's awesome. Signed, Shmuel. He doesn't get it. I don't have any friends named Shmuel. He doesn't understand. And what happens is, he goes back to Panovich on one of his breaks, and he ends up going there, and Rav Shmuel Rezavsky runs over to him, and he says, did you get my letter? Did you get my letter? I mean, you could see what sort of care he had. We're not about someone that was so against it. In fact, there's another story, this one I could even say, who? Rav Schechter, Rav Herschel Schechter, Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva University, my Rebbe also, he ends up going, after he gets married, he ends up going off to Israel. And he also married, he married a Shapiro. His father-in-law was one of the lesser Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas. Tremendous, tremendous rabbi. Friends with all of these great, great rabbis. So they end up eating by Rav Shmuel Rezavsky for Shabbos. And Rav Shmuel Rezavsky ends up being that they're talking. And Rav Shechter at this point is already a Rosh Kol. He's already the head of a kolel. The way it works in YU is that we take tests. If we don't do well in these tests, we're not asked to come back to the kollel. You got to get out of here. In terms of, you obviously are not meant necessarily for this type of learning. What happened was that Rav Shmuel said, I wish I could put the exact same thing here. And he said, I want to plan on this. I want to do this. I want to go ahead and I want to start something. What's going to happen is, all people that get married, I'll let them have 3 years. We'll collect enough money. They could go ahead and learn for 3 years. They'll take tests. And what happens is, those people that did fantastic, they'll continue learning. Those people that aren't, they should go to the army, and they should go and work. You try saying this to someone nowadays, oh my gosh. Just to contrast it to Rav Shach, which I'm going way ahead, but just to contrast it, Rav Shach said, no way. And in fact, when he was asked, should we start a whole yeshiva just for great students, he said, no way, because you have no idea which student is lagging now, but later on is going to become amazing. You see his hope that really everyone, and he was very much Torah learning, which we're going to talk about a little bit. Another story about Rav Shmuel Rezavsky, just another one. We mentioned this last week. It's incredible. He ends up, very unfortunately, dying of cancer in 1979. And the place where he went to Boston in order to get treatment. And when he was there, they asked him, they said, Rav Shmuel Rezavsky, what's the one thing we can get you? We'll get you whatever you want. We'll get you pizza. We'll get you this. We'll get you that. He says, the only thing I want is Rav Soloveitchik. I want you to bring me Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, 1979, and supposedly, according to the story, he came and they talked, and supposedly that was one of the only, you know, respites that he really had from the pain that he had from cancer. So we see someone, to give you another story, another way to contrast Rav Shach, someone, his name is Rav Elia Baruch. Rav Elia Baruch Finkel, he actually passed away a few years ago. He was supposed to be the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir. What happened was, he wanted to speak to Rav Soloveitchik one time. And what did he do? He went to Rav Shach, and Rav Shach told him, he says, you could speak to Rav Soloveitchik, you're just usher. You cannot go into the YU building. You can't. So what the story goes that Rav Elia Baruch went, and they start talking and everything, and then they're talking for hours about Torah and going back and forth. And the way the story goes, Rav Elia Baruch looks up, oh my gosh, I'm inside YU, and he runs out. That's the way the story goes. Yeah, obviously all the stuff I take with.
Why didn't they want him to go into YU?
Because this is something we're actually going to talk about. That's amazing. That's amazing. Thank you so much. Because you're going to see Rav Shach has letters. Rav Shach has Ma'amarim Uktavim, which are, I think it's three volumes. And he has these volumes, and he's got a whole bunch. He's got letters against Rav Soloveitchik. He's got letters against the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Rav Shach was very much, if you got to be Torah only, in terms of you can't be anything else. Kiruv, no. Messianism, obviously, no. But, you know, that's the main thing he was against Lubavitch for. But anything that includes, anything that has Torah and Mada and Torah and any sort of other thing mixed into it, is 100% asur, is not allowed, according to Rav Shach. Not allowed. In fact, to give you another example, in Panovich Yeshiva, they asked him, they said, can we go ahead, can we give a CPR course? Wouldn't it be a good idea for the yeshiva boys, in case someone in the lunchroom, chas v'shalom, something happens, should we teach them how to do CPR? Rav Shach said, no way. He says, you know why? Torah is going to protect them. It ain't going to happen around here. As you can see, it's a very, very, very different way of looking at things. An extremely, extremely different way of looking at things. So that should tell you about Rishon Rezavsky. What happened was Rishon Rezavsky passes away in 1979, and lo and behold, who takes over? Rav Shach. And I'm sure, as we've noticed all over, Rav Shach ends up being the complete opposite of Rishon Rezavsky. Rishon Rezavsky is this moderate, very much, I wouldn't even say, very... I would even say pro the Israeli army in terms of he wouldn't say his own students should go, but he's saying, listen, we care about it, we absolutely want it. But what happens is Rav Shach is none of that, absolutely none of that in the slightest. Also, Rav Shach, and we're going to talk a little bit later all about Rav Avadia's certain statements, but Rav Shach came out, for example, in 1990, they had a huge thing, I believe it was at Teddy Stadium, which is, I don't know, passed by Vagan, I don't remember what it's called, that whole area, wherever Teddy Stadium is, wherever that mall is, the Amacha, like right over there. And what happens is that he ends up going out and he starts talking about Chilonim. And what does he call Chilonim? He ends up calling them, oh, people that raise rabbits and pigs in order to eat. So that ends up being, you know, it's just so hard. It's so hard. I mean, it's very, very, very difficult. Very, very difficult. A small idea, just to show you guys that I'm not just coming out of, you know, left field, in terms of that this isn't 100% my own idea, but there's a great rabbi, his name is Rav Nassim Kamenetsky. Rav Nassim Kamenetsky came out with a sefer called Making of a Gadol. It's two volumes. I love it. It's one of my favorite sfarim in the entire world. For a short time, you could get it on eBay only for $1,500. The reason why is because Rav Eliashiv, who obviously did not speak English, came out very strongly against it. People translated stuff for him, passages. He said, no way. And ends up, it all has to be destroyed. Rav Nassim Kamenetsky came out with the whole thing, showing that like the whole thing was ridiculous. Rav Nassim Kamenetsky writes that when his father, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, was kicked out of Torah Vadas in 1979, which is a whole other story, when he was kicked out, he thought about going to two places. One place, Eretz Yisrael. The other place, building up Muncie. He chose Muncie, Eretz Yisrael in 1979, not the easiest place to live. So Rav Nassim Kamenetsky actually writes, he says, he believes that Rav Yaakov would have been the counter to Rav Shach. He would have been the more moderate to Rav Shach. But that does not happen. What happens is that Rav Shach, Torah only, Kolel, we're going to start an entire Kolel society. That is it. There's no talk about going to the army. There's nothing about any sort of pshara. There's no agreement that's going to come. It's just Torah. And in fact, he said, if they bring you over to the army and they force you, yahareg ve'al yavor. You should die rather than go to the Israeli army. That is how strong he felt. As we know, the three cardinal sins, adultery, idolatry, murder. But according to Rav Shach, he's saying, 100%, you must die rather than go to the Israeli army. Now this is very, very different than Rav Avadia. Very different. As opposed, as opposed to all of these other psakim, Rav Avadia never ever bought into any of this stuff. Never. Rav Avadia was, to say it a certain way, pro-army. In fact, I even have a picture over here. Where is it? I believe. Yeah, this actually happens to be over here. This is Rav Avadia's grandson. Rav Avadia's grandson. As you can see, you know, he's in an Israeli army uniform. Now, they also tell a story. I want to be very, very, you know, I like to be very honest about things. In fact, someone one time criticized me. They're like, why do you talk about all this stuff? I'm like, you got to know this. Rav Shach had a son named Dr. Ephraim Shach. Dr. Ephraim Shach, he ends up going to Yeshiva University. He ends up actually getting a doctorate from Revel. I know, it's crazy. The reason why, someone one time asked Rav Shach, he said, Rav Shach, why did your son go off the derech? I mean, we did not consider that off the derech. He said, you know why? Because at our Shabbat table, at our Shabbos table, we didn't sing Zmirot, we only learned the Rambam. We only learned the Rambam. That's the real answer he gave. And what happened was, Dr. Ephraim Shach, he ends up, it's very funny. I actually ended up being, for a short time, I would put this off for a second, but I was actually able to be in the YU archives for a day. I happened to lose a jacket, and what happened was, is that I was looking at I told my wife, I'm like, Shoshana, I'll be back in an hour, or like, I'll be back in 15 minutes, I just have to go find my jacket that I lost. They say the lost and found is over here. I end up going down the stairs, I go into this huge room, it's like the Cairo Geniza. I'm telling you, I walk in, I couldn't believe it. It was all of the old writings from YU, because they moved YU, I mean YU, when I was there, it was all 186, they moved all the way to 184th, and they moved all the REITs offices, it was all in this huge room. I found, and this is incredible, I end up showing up like 3 hours later, like back home. This is like, and there was no cell phone reception. My knees were like all dusty and everything, and like, I came back, I didn't find my jacket, never found it. But what happens is, I found the resume, I found Rav Ephraim Shach's resume. I didn't take any of this stuff, because that's not for me to take. Rav Ephraim Shach's resume, and it's hilarious. What does your father do? My father is one of the greatest rabbis in the entire world. It's hilarious. And he writes it. And his son actually ends up going to the Israeli army. And there's stories upon stories about these kids of Dr. Ephraim Shach. All sorts of stories about them coming into Padovich Yeshiva. And Rav Shach would see them from the very back of the yeshiva and run over to them, give them huge hugs. Obviously, you know, there was a tremendous amount of love for them, familial love. But obviously very, very, very much strongly disagreed with their life choice. Very strongly. So, what happened was, is that Rav Shach needs to find a way. How on earth am I going to now go ahead and harness all of these Sephardi voters? How am I going to get all of these Sephardim together? So Rav Shach, before, had been part of something called Agudas Yisrael. Agudas Yisrael was started by the Chavos Chaim, it was started by the Chaim Ozer, it was started by the Ger Rebbe. It was started by those three, and what happened was that eventually it became dominantly Hasidish, because, you know, They all vote the same way, obviously. And what happens is it becomes very, very, very Hasidish, and Rav Shach does not like this. He's disagreeing with a lot of the stuff that's going on. And he says, we have to do something else. So he says, you know what we're going to start? We're going to start something called Shas. What does Shas stand for? Shomrei Sefaradim. The keepers of the Sefaradim. And he says, how are we going to go ahead and get these voters to really buy into everything? We're going to put at his head a great Sephardi leader. Who on earth is a free agent right now? Who has no one coming over to the house? Who's, you know, you could say to a certain degree, I'm sure he was writing and everything, but bored and not really doing anything? Rav Avadia. Rav Avadia was at home, and Rav Shach says, I will make him into this huge, huge figure. In fact, there's even a quote from someone, one of the early people from Shach, says, our goal is to make Rav Avadia like Coca-Cola. I know, I'm not talking about that Coca-Cola ad, not that one, not the one everyone's angry at. But like, to make it so ubiquitous, to make Rav Avadia so well known that everyone knows him, and to tell you the truth, it works. Rav Avadia is the only rabbi in all of Israel who every single person, whether or not you're the most Haredi of the Haredi, whether or not you're the most Chiloni of the Chiloni, you 100% know who Rav Avadia is. Whether or not that's for good or for bad, we'll talk about that in a little bit. And what happens is that Rav Shach, it's very interesting, he starts Shas as a reaction to all of this Ashkenazi patronage, to all of this Ashkenazi, there's a tremendous amount of condescension that's being done towards the Sephardim, and he says, we need to harness all of this power, and we need to have them vote for Haredi parties, we need to have them vote for ultra-Orthodox parties. And what happens is, in all of the writings and all of the newspapers at this time, Rav Avadia is called the Gadol. He's the rabbi par excellence. There's Rav Shach, and right underneath there's Rav Avadia. In terms of, you have him absolutely the biggest rabbi in the world, aside from Rav Shach. And you end up with this huge party. Now, it didn't become a huge party overnight. Originally, what happened was the story that Aryeh Deri tells, and it's a great story, and it really tells you a lot about Rav Avadia, is that that first night, now Aryeh Deri, he mortgaged his entire house just to be able, for the campaign to actually be able to have enough money. And what happened was that night, when they're announcing all of the mandates, Shas won 4 mandates. Now that is a huge deal. I don't know that much about Israeli politics, but for a new party to get that many, that is a huge deal. And everyone is celebrating, everyone's jumping around, all the Sephardim are so happy, and they go over to Rav Avadia and they say, Rav Avadia, we won 4 seats. What does Rav Avadia say? He says, Yofi, what can we learn now? That's the only thing he cared about. He only cared about learning Torah. And that's why Rav Avadia's foray into politics was tremendously utilitarian. As opposed to other people that joined the politics because, you know, they want the limelight, because they want all this stuff, Rav Avadia saw it as a way to be able to create something that was unable to be done before. The state, and this is all stuff that obviously I feel very, very, you know, rough talking about, but this is important, very, very important. Already from the birth of the state, the status of Sephardim was definitely second class. They were seen as backward, they were seen as religious fanatics, they were seen as like completely second class citizens, and really it was terrible. And one of the main things that the state decided to do, and we even have papers about this, it's very, very, very troubling, it hurts me tremendously, but what happened was that they took a lot of the Sephardim and they tried moving them away from their own traditions and moved them over to a Zionist, to a socialist conception of thinking. In fact, there's a great rabbi right now in Israel, his name is Rav Mahpud from Bnei Brak. If you guys have ever been to Israel, his Heksher, it's Heksher Badaz, it's called Badaz Beit Yosef, no it's not, it's called Badaz Yoredeya, sorry, it's called Badaz Yoredeya. Rav Mahpud, at the 10-year anniversary, he told an amazing story. He said that when he was young, he obviously came from Tehman, I shouldn't say obviously, he came from Tehman. And what happened was, is that he was put into one of these merkazei klita. He was brought into one of these kibbutzim, one of these places where they're going to accept them, where they're going to absorb them in. And he's going to become socialist. He's going to become Zionist. He's going to become all this. He says he was very, very young at the time. Every single night he would sneak out. He would run over to his mom, and his mom used to hold his head on her knees. And what she used to do, she used to feel the place where he used to have peyot. They shaved off his peyote and she would just sit there and cry. And he says because of those tears, he was zocheh. He merited becoming such a great rabbi and actually having one of the best hechsherim in all of Israel. So that should tell you a small, small part. I don't want to get too much into this because I don't want to get sidetracked at all. But it was a very, 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 very big problem. Very, very big problem. There was a whole group, it was called, if you want to hear it in Hebrew, it's called the Pantarim Hashchorim. It's called the Black Panthers. It was run by a person named Charlie Bitton. Charlie Bitton was secular. What he wanted to do, he wanted to be, you know, following the Black Panthers, you know, the Olympics are coming up, but you know, following the Black Panthers. What happens is, he wants to start the same revolution in Israel. He wants equal rights for Sephardim. Unfortunately, he ends up failing tremendously. It does not work out. But who did succeed? Rav Avadia. Rav Avadia succeeded beyond anyone's conception. In terms of beyond what anyone would ever think, Rav Avadia succeeded in raising the status of Sephardim. This population had little rights. This population had nothing. And anything they wanted, they had to go ahead and beg the Ashkenazim. Please give us a little bit. Give us a few crumbs. Give us something. What Rav Avadia was able to set up, whether or not you agree with it or not, he set up a mini welfare state. Where basically he said, we're already living in this welfare state in Israel, where so many people are already on the chalukah. So many people are getting so much money from the government. We want our own. And therefore Rav Avadia used his political clout in order to get that. And that was a huge deal. Because before then, education, problematic. Food, problematic. Benefits, impossible to get. Very, very, very difficult for the Sephardim living in Israel. In fact, even nowadays it's not so easy. I mean, it's obviously gotten better by leaps and bounds in terms of its if you speak to people that were around back then, it's like a whole different story. But nowadays, even now, for example, just to bring an example, in Kiryat Sefer, which is a very, very, very Haredi town, their school says we will only accept 30% Sephardim. Nothing above 30%, that's it. They obviously did not have Brown versus Board of Education yet, in terms of this is a major issue, and every single year, now I don't know how exactly I worked this past year, but every single year what happens is, and you'll see it all on the Yeshiva World and versus Nice, is that Rav Eliashiv, this is already from a few years ago, Rav Eliashiv will come out and say, the schools are not opening until every single Sephardi person gets a school, gets a Beis Yaakov that they want to go to. And usually it takes 2 or 3 days, because no school wants to say, yeah, let's go accept these Sephardim, because unfortunately this still lingers. I mean, amongst the Dati Lumi world, amongst the more Zionistic world, this is basically nil, thank God, Baruch Hashem. But amongst the Haredi world, it's still a major, major problem. In fact, I'll tell a story. This is a personal story. One of my very, very close family members, he went to a very right-wing yeshiva. And what happened was, he met with the shadchan, he met with the marriage advisor, whatever you want to call it, and he ends up talking, and, oh my gosh, you're such a great guy, you're amazing, you're incredible, there's just one thing I want you to change. One thing. Your last name is Cazorla. Cazorla is a town in Spain. It's undoubtedly Sephardi. Change that name, and you get whatever girl you want. Change your last name to Stern, Ginsburg, Goldberg, whatever you want. Change your last name, and you'll get whatever girl you want. Now you tell me, where's Sinat Chinam nowadays? I love everyone in this room. You guys rock. Coming out here at 8 o'clock at night. You know, coming here to Shiurim. You guys are amazing. But like, where do you see Sinat Chinam? Unfortunately, you see it right there. It kills me so much. And as Rav Kook, I know we're not talking about Rav Kook, but Rav Kook says something beautiful. He says, how do we bring Mashiach? Ava Chinam. Love, this unrequited love for all Jews. And that's something that we all have to, I'm talking to myself. This is something that I have to build within myself. Yes? Amazing.
We never heard Kasher Gladen. It's either you're Jewish or you're not Jewish. And they didn't know what it means to hate another Jew. That hurt them so much. But they couldn't understand. And this came from Europe, all this hate and making different kind of Jews.
Absolutely.
It was so hard for the Sephardim, especially the educated one, to understand.
Absolutely. That reminds me of a great story. Benjamin Cardozo, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, passed away in 1938. He belonged to a shul on the Upper West Side. Now it's 70th and Central Park West. Beautiful windows, Sherith Israel. Amazing, amazing shul. Now it's Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, who's tremendous before him, is my own teacher, Rabbi Chaim Angel. Really, really, really tremendous. Before that, Rabbi Dr. Mark Angel. Chief Justice Cardozo, there was a whole discussion in the early teens, I believe, and they were discussing, should we turn Sherith Israel into a mixed seating synagogue, or should we have it as a separate seating synagogue? At that point, Orthodox shuls were trying as fast as they can to uproot their mechitzas and try to get with the times, and let's go ahead and become conservative. And Sherith Israel was also part of this. Cardozo came down. Now, he didn't go every single Shabbat. This is the way the story is told. What happened was that he comes and he says, listen, I want to daven. I want to pray at a synagogue that my grandparents prayed at. That for me, to be a Sephardi Jew, to be someone so traditional, you don't have to, there's not an issue of reform. It's we do the way that we're supposed to do it. So there was never, it did not even cross their mind. After Cardozo came up, it basically like finish the entire conversation. And because of that, it most certainly, it's got a beautiful balcony. If you've ever been, it's gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. I love it. You know, I don't know, it's amazing. So we discussed how Rav Avadia is supposed to unite everybody through the social. We said he starts the Shas party, bring everyone together, we're going to fight against the Ashkenazi oppression. We're going to bring everyone together. Halachically, how do we bring everyone together? And this moves on to Rav Avadia's next very, very big thing. Before then, things were very, very fragmented. This person follows the Ben Ish Chai, this person follows the Moroccan Minagim, this person follows the Syrian Minagim, this person follows everything. Rav Avadia said there's one rabbi, and that's it. Who's that rabbi? The Beit Yosef. Rav Yosef Cairo. Yosef Cairo, he was born in 1488, actually in Toledo, Spain. He was obviously kicked out at the age of 4 of Spain. He ended up going to Turkey and eventually settling in Sfat. He was part of this Kabbalistic circle with the Ariza and Rav Moshe Cordovero and the Ma'ari Beirav, this very, very mystical group. But what's fascinating is that he ends up writing an entire sefer. He ends up writing the Shulchan Aruch, which barely has any sort of mystical influence. In terms of very, very, very straight, he ends up not mixing a lot of the stuff, and that ends up being fantastic. Because at the very same time in Poland, the Rama is writing his own book, and already the Shulchan Aruch comes out, and he says, this thing is amazing, I'm going to write glosses. And that ends up being amazing, because each one of them would have published their book separately, it probably wouldn't be as accepted as it is nowadays, because since it was something that was both acceptable to Ashkenazim and Sephardim, end up becoming tremendously popular. And Rav Avadia says, what are we going to go ahead and follow? We're only going to follow Rabbi Yosef Cairo. We're only going ahead and do that. And that's a huge deal. That's a very, very huge deal. Because many, many Sephardim don't hold like Rabbi Yosef Cairo. Just to give you a small idea, the Moroccans don't eat rice on Pesach. I know, like, what's the point of being Sephardi? Like, I don't get it. It's really hard. It's like crazy. Not me. It's my fault. Sorry. But basically, you have the Moroccans. I'll give you another example. Moroccans, they held like the Ramah. You don't have to be glot. As we know, for example, I tell my students this all the time, there's two different types of kashrut. There's glot. I don't want to get into whether or not the glot we have nowadays is a real glot. I don't want to talk about that. But the reason why Hebrew National has a triangle K is because it is not glot. Because what happens is, on the lungs, it's possible that there was a lesion on the lungs, and what happened was that the lesion was taken off. According to the OU and according to the other kashrut agencies, something that is glot does not have any sort of lesion on it at all. And what happens is, Sephardim have to eat glot. In fact, Sephardim are unable to eat non-glot. It's not allowed. It actually ends up being, Rav Avadia does have a tshuva somewhat against this, but ends up being very, very close to eating not kosher, which is a very, very, very big deal. And what happens is, the Moroccans never had that minhag. Moroccans always ate non-glot. In fact, if you take a look at a sefer called Hod Yosef Chai, in the introduction by Rav Yaakov Ariel, he's one of the Zionist Gedolim nowadays, in Ramat Gan, he writes that in the very beginning, he says, do not forget that the Moroccans, they always held by not-glot, and it's perfectly okay for a Moroccan to hold like that. But what happens is, as Rav Avadia says, everyone has to hold like the Beit Yosef. And this caused one of my pet peeves, people coming up to me, Rabbi Kasorla, can I please become Sephardi? It's awesome to become Sephardi. I mean, kind of awesome. So I wake up for Sichot, all of Elul. It's like 40 days of waking up, like very, very early. So that, I don't know if you want to trade that so much. Whatever, it was a lot easier. Yeah, except for that. You know, whatever, pick and choose. Yeah, it's fine. But basically, I'll give you an example. My wife and I, we decided we're going to stay in Eretz Yisrael for Pesach. What do? We went out and we bought all glass utensils. And we use those glass utensils during the year. For chametz, there's bread all over it. According to Shulchan Aruch, in order to kosher it, all you have to do, you take a sponge, clean it off, it's done. Why? Because Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, something that's pre-Mishnaic, says very clearly that glass is not bolea. Glass does not go ahead and does not actually absorb. It doesn't absorb anything. So therefore, Sephardim 100% hold that way. It could be the easiest Pesach ever. Just everything's all glass. Millions of things in terms of just tons. I have a student, Aaron Katz. He's constantly asking me, Rabbi, can I please be Sephardi? I'm like, maybe. I don't know. You're awesome. I'll take you. But basically, this is a very, very big misnomer. People say, you know what? Rav Avadia says everyone has to follow Beit Yosef, including Ashkenazim. As we discussed before, Rav Avadia, He loved history. He knew everything. He knew all about the different aliyot, the aliyah of the Hasidim who went up, the aliyah of the Vilna Gaon. He knew about all of this. They're all holding by their own particular minagim. In fact, when asked, this should be like the example, when asked, can Ashkenazim eat kitniyot in Israel? He writes, no way. And he writes a funny line. He says, Ashkenazim hayotzim biyad rama. What that means is Ashkenazim who hold, now it really means with an outstretched arm, but he writes it with an aleph. Hayotzim biyad rama. Those people that follow the Rama, Rav Moshe Israelis, they cannot eat kitniyot. They are not able to. In fact, Mark Shapiro, I'm quoting again, because he loves Rav Avadi, which is incredible. He has an amazing letter from Rav Avram Yosef and Rav Yitzchak Yosef, two sons of Rav Avadia, that say it's all one huge misnomer. People think, well, you move to Israel, you gotta follow the Beit Yosef. In fact, Rav Avadia says, if you have your own personal minagim, no way. Absolutely not for Ashkenazi. He says one particular case. He says, if you're Ashkenazi, you know you're from Germany, you know you're from Poland, you know you're from Russia, and you're not affiliated, and you come to Eretz Yisrael, and you become religious through Sephardim, take all the Sephardi minagim. If I wasn't Sephardi already, I'd become not religious and then run back to Israel and then do it all. Whatever. Just a small idea. So basically, yeah. All right. So how did the other sects of Sephardim take to this? So there's been a lot of pushback. There's been a lot. There's like a whole cottage industry. I love this because like my addiction, unfortunately, you could ask my wife, not like a TLC show, but my addiction is Sephardim, are books. I don't have enough bookshelves in my own house. It's really a problem. I don't know. Every time she's like, you could buy one more book, and I end up buying three in the mail. It's a big problem. It's a very, very big problem. So what happens is that there's so many Sfarim that have been coming out now that I just love. I crack up at them. Because they're new Sfarim by Moroccan rabbis who they're fighting against Rav Avadia. In fact, we even have one right over here in the library over here. It's hilarious. All these ones that are saying, well, Rav Avadia says that that Moroccans should eat rice. And he writes that. Moroccans should eat rice. Then you have a whole essay. No, Moroccans have to follow their own minhag. But you know what? Even though the Moroccans are very strong, even though they're writing these books, even though they're very numerous, nevertheless, I mean, this is my own personal thing, I don't think it's changing at all. In fact, someone so amazing, like the main person that he used to fight with a lot of people, but one of the main people was a great rabbi named Rav Mesas. Rav Mesas, he was a tremendous, tremendous gaon, a tremendous gadol. Rav Shalom Mesas, he was the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. Really, really incredible. He writes an amazing introduction to Yabia Omer, which is Rav Avadia Sefer. And he writes something amazing, the most poetic, beautiful Sephardi language you could see, extolling how amazing Rav Avadia is. How could Rav Avadia write so many books and still do all these things for the Tzibur and still be so amazing? You can see even people that fight with him, and he most certainly does. Me'or Veshemesh, for example, is one of his Sfarim where he disagrees with Rav Avadia. You can see very, very, very clearly he loves Rav Avadia. And you see, just someone of this caliber, it's impossible. It's just not going to happen. In fact, this I find hilarious. This, unfortunately, I left this school. I want to bring it in. But there's a Koran Sidur that was just published a couple years ago. It's called Chachmei Morocco. Koran, the publishing house from Israel, doing great stuff now in terms of the whole Steinsaltz Shas that's new, that's fantastic, that I love, I use in my own class. And what happens is that they came out with this thing, Chachmei Morocco. And what it has on the bottom of every single page, all of the minagim, all the different stuff that the Moroccans do. If you take a look at the introduction, you can see I love reading introductions. The whole book, I don't know, but the introduction definitely. But basically, you see the introduction. Who is it? It's Rav Shlomo Amar, the former chief rabbi of Israel, before Rav Yitzchak Yosef. And he writes an entire thing in the beginning where he says, this whole Sidur is basically just for decoration. Because we all follow the Beit Yosef, and we all follow Rav Avadia. So don't use this Sidur. It's hilarious, because it's like, wait, but this is all published right now. It's very interesting. There's only one other case that I've ever seen like this. There's a sefer that was published. It's two volumes. It's called Ve'alei Lo Yibol. What it is some person from Merkaz Arav used to go over to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's house. He used to walk over and used to ask him all sorts of questions. He ended up writing down all of the questions. It's a very, very difficult sefer to learn. Very, because he even writes there, I have no idea what Shlomo Zalman said. And like you're trying to figure out. You're like, okay, all right. But what it has a non-haskama in the beginning by one of Shlomo Zalman's kids, where he writes, don't publish this book, please. You asked my father while he was walking. These things are not meant to be printed. That's the only other thing I've ever seen anything like this. But yeah, so it's very interesting. You see the influence, and you see so much stuff going on and on and on in terms of the Sephardi world. One major thing that Mark Shapiro loves bringing up is that if you go into any Sephardi shul, Like, for example, we have one right over here. You go over there, most of the Sidurim, most of them, I'd say about 99% of them, all come with the Minagim of Rav Ovadia. That's really his influence, not to mention all of his kids and all everything like that. We really, man, once again, I can't believe this. It's really crazy. So what happens is, oh my gosh, part three next week. No, I'm just kidding. No. I'm just kidding. So what happens is that for 10 years, things are great between Rav Ovadia and Rav Shach. Things are amazing. Things are going well. Rav Shach's party is becoming more and more powerful. It's great. And finally, in 1993, you end up having the Oslo Accords, and you have this whole discussion. Should we do it? Should we not do it? Now, at that year, Shach happened to have 17 seats in the Knesset. They were huge. And what happened was that Rav Shach says, we're not going to go ahead and join the Rabin government. We're not going to allow the Oslo Accords to happen. But Rav Ovadia, as we mentioned last week, he was very much for land for peace. He was someone who was a dove, and he really did believe at that time, he listened to the generals, yes, there could be peace with the Palestinians, let's go ahead with the Oslo Accords. Rav Shach said, no way! Rav Ovadia said, absolutely. And in 1992, this is 92, a little bit before, Rav Shach actually comes out, because this whole discussion was going on for quite a while, Rav Shach comes out, and he says publicly, Sephardim don't know how to lead. You know why? Because what happened was that they never had to deal with reform. We had to deal with reform and conservative and people that were religious and people who were trying to mess with us and people who were trying to mess with Israel and mess with the religious structure of life. But Sephardim, they don't have that issue, as the Mira says so beautifully. They don't have that issue. So for Sephardim can't deal with this, we shouldn't listen to Rav Ovadia. This comment by Rav Shach was put on every single Pashkevil. That's like a big poster. They usually put it up right before Shabbos, because that way you can't take it down. It's hilarious. Like, you walk there and you're like, you know, you're walking to shul and like you see some guy like with this thing going ahead. It's very cool. You got to be like Hasidish and hold Rabbeinu Tam like very, very late. That way no one will take it down. So what happens is that this is a huge, huge fight that's going on. Rav Ovadia decides, I'm going to break away from you, Rav Shach. He forces Aryeh Deri, who had been already someone very, very close to Rav Shach, he forces him to go against his own mentor and says, go ahead and sign the accord, sign into the government, which will eventually lead to the Oslo Accords. As we know, that ended up being a very, very, very big problem. And what happened was is that this is actually, I don't know if you can see it, it's hilarious. This is a fight in one of the Haredi newspapers. You see Rav Shach. What does Rav Shach say? Ovadia Yosef, and I have been rabbi, don't worry. He doesn't know how to learn. And then what does Rav Ovadia answer? He says, who's that ken? Who tell me da? What is that? Mitam Tamim. Sorry, I can't tell you the context. Mitam Tamimoto. What it means is that Rav Ovadia is saying that Rav Shach, he's being told all sorts of stuff by his handlers. And therefore, he has no idea what's flying. And therefore, you see it really boiled over. It was a major, major, major problem. But Rav Ovadia had become so powerful by that time, he didn't need Rav Shach anymore. And Rav Shach starts Degel HaTorah. All sorts of stories about, you know, fights between the two. Someone even got up in Porat Yosef, which where Rav Ovadia learned. And someone got up and started making fun of Rav Ovadia. And one of the Purim spiels, Rav Ovadia wrote a beautiful, it's in Yechavedat, beautiful thing where he's completely against Purim spiels. He says, these are 100% asur, is not allowed, no way. A blazing tshuva, absolutely asur, not allowed. And Rav Ovadia, he would not mochel the person until the person really, really, really felt bad. Now, this is up to a lot of debate. Was Rav Shach right? You could say, at the end of the day, when you get, Shulamit Aloni, for example, who recently just passed away, you saw her obituary in the New York Times. She was, you know, someone obviously who was not so keen on religious Judaism. Rav Ovadia has many, many, many comments about her. Very, very, very interesting stuff. And the question is, was it such a good idea? Her comments, her anti-religious comments actually ended up having her leave. She was the Minister of Education. It was a whole disaster. And obviously we all know what sort of disaster Oslo was, which, you know, oh my. So, Rav Ovadia was tremendously affected by politics. It would be that if Rav Ovadia would not have gone to politics, he would be a much greater rabbi. He would be someone that would be lauded by every single segment, lauded, by every single segment of Judaism. Whether or not, you know, whatever you are, you would 100% love him no matter what. But once he entered politics, he ran into a lot of other issues with politics. One thing I want to deal with right now, graft. Unfortunately, as we know, Aryeh Deri, his main advisor, ended up spending years in jail. And even though when, you know, you're walking around Israel and you see all sorts of stickers, free Deri, he did nothing wrong. it's a big, big problem. Very, very big problem. This is why one of my Rosh Yeshiva, he says it's 100% mutar, it's 100% okay to speak Lashon Hara about anyone in the Knesset. Now, he's saying as a joke. I don't know. I don't know how much of a joke it is. But it's a major... What? Yeah, I mean, that's 100% true. But anytime, I mean, we all see now, the Sochi Olympics. You know, what's going on now? $40 billion. I mean, all this graft that's going on there is awful. But then, I mean, I'm not going to explain it away. I mean, it's absolutely chil Hashem. It's absolutely terrible. And, like, there's really no good way of explaining it. It's really, really, really problematic. And what happens is, so Rav Avadya flips the script. Before, everything was complete Ashkenazi. Now everything is completely Sephardi. Now when it comes to these religious parties, they go ahead and they beg Shas to go ahead and really work their magic. And really things have changed tremendously. Things have changed tremendously. So I just want to, since this is actually called People of the Book and not just me getting up and talking, I apologize. Before that, I actually want to discuss something because people wanted me to talk about this before. Rav Avadya, he did have a penchant for saying very, very, very crazy comments. Now, there's no way of really getting around it. There's really, really no way of getting around it. And a lot of it has to do, like we spoke about before, just think about LeBron James. He comes from a very uncultured background. He comes from a Sephardi background that was very much second-class citizens. He comes from a very, very poor background where this type of language was accepted. It's terrible. I mean, I'm definitely not condoning it. There are people around his circle that say all sorts of very interesting things, like, you know, one of them says that he's misquoted. Another group, for example, say he doesn't realize what sort of influence he has. I mean, obviously, it's a very, very, no, I mean, it's a little bit naive to say, for example, that like someone like Rav Avadya, who, as we see over here, prime ministers and presidents and, you know, Prime Minister Blair, all these people going ahead and meeting Rav Avadya, that he doesn't know that he has that type of influence, it's a little bit difficult to say. What it really comes down to, at least this is what I think, this is something that really Dr. Benny Lau really comes through, is that really you have to accept, at least right now, the fact that like you're uncomfortable with some of it, but that shouldn't be the total of the person. That even though, now I want to discuss some of these. So for example, one example, and I want to make this very clear, these are bothersome to me, 100%. The Holocaust. So Rav Avadya came out and said, he said that the reason why people died in the Holocaust, now, and there's a major issue whether or not we should talk about things like this, he ends up saying that the reason why people died in the Holocaust was because they are former neshamot, they're former souls that had sinned, and therefore Hashem wanted them to pass away. Now, like, it's extremely uncomfortable for me to even talk about it. However, like when it comes, push comes to shove, there was an article, for example, in Jewish Observer in 1977, I'm not going to say the Rosh Yeshiva, but he blames the entire Holocaust and the Zionist movement. So I'm saying, like, to believe this type of mystical thing that these souls, I'm not saying, you know, I like it. I most certainly don't like it, but I'm saying it's like, it's somewhat understandable coming where he comes from. Katrina, for example, he came out and he said the punishment for New Orleans was because America really pushed, because Bush really came out and pushed Israel to go ahead and do Gush Katif. I remember at the time there was an article, the Washington Jewish Times or whatever it was, there was an article by this girl, and she must have been like 13 or 14, and she wrote this article against Rav Avadya. And she writes, Rav Avadya should go ahead and step down from his position. And it's funny, because when it comes to Gedolei Hador, when it comes to big rabbis, there's no such thing, there's not a position, it's not like he was the head of anything. He's just Rav Avadya, so therefore people come to him. So it was a bit silly, like, Rav Avadya should abdicate his throne. For what? Like, what are you talking about? There's no throne, it doesn't happen. So therefore, you know, he has that statement, which obviously, you know, is what to talk about. There are other times where most certainly he was misunderstood. For example, recently there were the forest fires. We were actually, my wife and I were in Eretz Yisrael at the time. There were forest fires. Rav Avadya came out, he said, why are there forest fires? Because the Gemara says that fires happen because of Chilul Shabbat, because people are not keeping Shabbat. So this was all over the media. People were freaking out. Rav Avadya is making fun of people that don't keep Shabbat. However, Rav Avadya clarified later. He said, no, I wasn't talking about the irreligious. They don't know any better. What am I talking about? I'm talking about the religious Jews that are lax in Shabbat. They're doing a bad issue. Obviously, you know, these types of, like, you know, women, for example, he says that women, their place should be at home, you know, making chamin, which is like Sephardi cholent, and, you know, they should be in their house. It's a big problem, but, like, the thing, this is at least something that, you know, this is the way that I quasi-rationalize it, is that you just take a look at what he did during his life, what he did for women, what he did for agunot, what he does for the whole concept of bar mitzvah, and like we spoke about pants, and we spoke about, there's a million other examples like that also. His own daughter, for example, I don't know if anyone knows, but Adina Bar Shalom, for example, that's Rav Ovadia's daughter. She started the Haredi Jerusalem College, which she's trying to go ahead and help the Haredi community get some sort of secular learning to be able to really get out of this whole cycle of poverty. And all of this is all done with Rav Ovadia's blessing. And she is interesting also in terms of, I'll explain this just in a second. Rav Ovadia also came out and he said that Arabs are snakes, for example. He says that they're snakes. Now, whether or not, you know, you want to say it's true or not, I mean, you know. But basically, it ends up being that Rav Ovadia, his own relationship with Arabs was tremendous. When he was back in Cairo, there's all these stories. He used to have all sorts of, I mean, this is beautiful for nowadays. You know, when CRC comes out and says you can't, you know, drink in Starbucks, he used to go ahead and he used to, you know, sit at the coffee houses of Cairo, these amazing places, and sit with Arabs and talk politics and talk interesting stuff. In fact, all the stuff was all publicized after he died, but all of his relationship with Mubarak, for example, whether or not you believe Mubarak is some sort of some sort of butcher to his own people, you know, whatever it is, whatever that case is, WikiLeaks has most certainly shown us that Mubarak was working very, very closely with Israel. And a big part of this, Rav Ovadia was sent as a special delegate by Shimon Peres. In fact, when Mubarak first got sick, what happened was Rav Ovadia sent a Refuah Shleima letter. Like, you know, you should feel better. So what Rav Ovadia said, I mean, he also clarified his comments also, and I absolutely believe him about this. He doesn't want death to all, you know, to all Palestinians, to all Arabs. He doesn't want that. What he wants death to those people that want to hurt the Jewish people. He doesn't want that. So this is just like, I hope this is just like a small tipa, just a little bit, this is just a drop to try to understand, because this is the key, and this will end. No, we didn't even get to do the book stuff. Oh my gosh. So what happens is, man, we could talk for a lot about this. So what happens is, at the end of the day, Rav Ovadia, a very flawed person, as we just saw a little bit, but also someone who years and years and years from now, we're not going to remember any of this stuff. Baruch Hashem, this is the way life works. We're not going to remember stuff. We're only going to remember the good. We're only going to go ahead and remember the good. And what's happening is that because Rav Ovadia, this is something I made right before, this, to those people that don't know what this is called, it's called a meme. A meme. A meme means, I even gave the translation, element of culture. So what happened is, this is a meme I made the other day in school, just for fun. I showed my students. Because what happens is, sometimes during davening, they get pulled out to go work on yearbook because there's not enough time. So what it is, it's like, it's from a particular show that my students know. Rav Ovadia's son, for example, now is the chief rabbi. And a lot of people, they like discussing. They like saying, oh, the reason why he's chief rabbi is because he's Rav Ovadia's son. It's not true. The reason why is because he really is 100% one of the Gedolei Ador, and he's someone who really went ahead and really did a great, great job in terms of continuing his father's teachings. This is the last picture. I showed this at the very end of last class. This is really, in 300 years, when we talk about Rav Ovadia, we're not going to think about the forest fire, we're not going to think about the Holocaust, we're not going to think about women, we're not going to think about any of that stuff. We're going to only think about the good, we're going to think about the Agunot, we're going to think about how he helped Sephardi Jewry, you know, turn around years and years and years of condescension, years and years and years of privation, all sorts of horrible stuff. We're going to think about that. We're not going to think about him, you know, and unfortunately in the way that unfortunately in certain circles he's most certainly portrayed. Thank you so, so much.